Hey, Token CEO listeners, you can find every episode on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
God, this episode is just flowing. It is Tuesday, June 15th. This is episode 162 of the Token CEO podcast. We are presented by Sports Research. I'm going to dedicate this ad read to M. Najeki, I think is how we pronounce her name. She is a gorgeous creature. As far as I can tell, she lives in Boston. The girl will not stop running. So she tags us every day. She runs all the time. She's always smiling. She's usually in run club gear. And she makes working out look gorgeous and fun. So if you feel like trying to work out and think that you could have half the chance of making it look gorgeous and fun, which I am a far cry from that. Sports Research is a great brand that can help you do that. You can get collagen, you can get vitamins, you can get an at-home workout kit. You can also try Sweet Sweat, which is their product that helps improve recovery and circulation, and best of all, makes you sweat so that you feel like you've had an extremely productive workout. I think women are gorgeous when they sweat, so who doesn't like to sweat? If you go to sportsresearch.com, you add Sweet Sweat to your basket. You can use code NRC and get that Sweet Sweat stick for free. Or you can just check out and use code TOKEN and get 30% off your entire order. And just a big shout out and thanks to M. Najeki. What do you think her first name is? Oh, Megan. All right. Rachel thinks her name is Megan. Marissa. I think it's Maureen. Whoa. I've been stalking her. What do you guys call that when you stalk somebody on Instagram? I've been creeping on her. Okay. Her mother looks like she might have red hair, so maybe she's Irish. So Maureen, Marissa, and what's the other? Megan. All right. We'll see what the answer is. Anyways, but shout out to her and congratulations on running. All right. So we got a big episode today. We've got a whole bunch of stuff to cover. We're talking big tech. We're talking about Call Her Daddy moving to Spotify. We're going to cover what's happening with Netflix going direct to consumer. And then we have an awesome guest, which is the fashion designer, Rebecca Minkoff. And then we're going to cap the episode off with some voicemails. All right, so let's start with the headlines. First headline, Friday afternoon, you were probably out golfing or boozing it up or having some high noons or creeping on people's Instagrams. I was looking at news articles. The biggest one was that Congress announced 5 new antitrust bills. So the antitrust bills are targeted at Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Apple, otherwise known as the FANG companies, if you threw Netflix in there. This would be, if these bills passed, they would be the biggest antitrust laws in decades. If you read anything about the FANG companies, and in particular, Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Apple, there is a lot of discussion about not only the size of these companies. Those companies account for $6.4 trillion in market cap, which is a fuck ton of money. Those companies have not been regulated, and as a result, they have essentially been able to build all sorts of types of businesses. They've been able to put all sorts of other types of businesses out of business. So essentially, what this legislation would do is it would ban companies like Facebook or like Google from promoting their own products to the disadvantage of their competitors. And the reality is obviously these companies are extremely smart, they're global, they're extremely large, they yield an incredible amount of margin and drive a ton of revenue. And because they own all the data, they own the platforms, they've created the algorithm, it is very easy, according to Congress, for these companies to disadvantage their competitors. And to be honest, I think you've probably seen a ton of cases of them doing this. So what the legislation will essentially do is serve to break up these platforms and to prohibit them from creating disadvantages for their competitors who are using their platforms. I think this is necessary. You know, it's a controversial topic. I think there's a lot of question about why this hasn't happened yet to date. I also think that what you're seeing with Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Apple is essentially they've created the gold mine. They've created the train that goes to the gold mine. They've created the marketplace where people buy the gold from the train that came from the gold mine. So what Congress is saying, and probably a little bit late to the game, is that it's time for them to be regulated in this process. Whenever you hear Zuckerberg or any of, you know, if you look at, if you hear Mark Zuckerberg talking about it, he always dances around the regulation question.
Who's your biggest competitor?
Senator, we have a lot of competitors.
Who's your biggest?
I think the categories of... Do you want just one? I'm not sure I can give one, but can I give a bunch?
Mm-hmm.
So there are three categories that I would focus on. One are the other tech platforms, so Google, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft. We overlap with them in different ways.
Do they provide the same service you provide?
In different ways, different
let me,
parts
let me put
of it,
this
yes.
way. If I buy a Ford and it doesn't work well and I don't like it, I can buy a Chevy. If I'm upset with Facebook, what's the equivalent product that I can go sign up for?
Well, there's the second category that I was going to talk about.
I'm not talking about categories. I'm talking about is there real competition you face? Because car companies face a lot of competition. If they make a defective car, it gets out in the world, people stop buying that car, they buy another one. Is it an alternative to Facebook in the private sector?
Yes, Senator. The average American uses 8 different apps to communicate with their friends and stay in touch with people, ranging from texting apps to email.
Which is the same service you provide?
Well, we provide a number of different services.
Is Twitter the same as what you do?
It overlaps with a portion of what we do.
You don't think you have a monopoly?
It certainly doesn't feel like that to me.
Europe, I think, has been far more aggressive, especially around the area of privacy. But what is interesting to see is that Congress is finally waking up to the size, the power, and the impact on the marketplace that all of these companies have. I think personally that it's going to be the biggest issue for Facebook more than Google, Amazon, or Apple. If I were to rank order, I would say Facebook first, Apple second, Google third, and then Amazon. When you think about Google's business or you think about Amazon's business, like if Amazon was to spin out the cloud business, like it doesn't really affect the core business. If Amazon was to spin out the Prime business, sure, that would have a little bit more of an impact. When you look at Facebook, Facebook doesn't have untangled businesses. All of Facebook's businesses seem to really orbit around the consumer who's spending time on the social platform. Apple obviously has a hardware business. They have a software business. It's easier to think about decoupling the two. And then Google is in all sorts of businesses, which I think you could argue would very effectively and or possibly easily operate independently. So that's the first big headline. We'll see what comes out of that. All right. So speaking of monopolies, one of the things I always talk about and think about a lot is how Facebook in particular, but also Google, and of course, I think how Facebook in particular, but I think you can say the same for Amazon, Apple, and Google, is the way that Facebook and big tech have affected independent publishers. You know, essentially what's happened is because more and more people get all of their news, their entertainment, their information from social platforms, it's changed the power dynamic with publishers. I always talk about this on the pod. I remember meeting the general counsel of Hearst, and she was telling me that, you know, they used to charge $1 for content pre-Facebook. And then when they gave their content to Facebook, they got 25 cents for that same piece of content. So I think in life and in technology and in business, there's always the question of, is it better to have more eyeballs at a lower rate, or is it better to have more eyeballs that you own at a higher margin? And I think that's the age-old question, right? Do you, you know, in our world, do we want to have a content business that we monitor that is independent, that exists on its own URL or in its own domain? And are we comfortable and can we command the single highest price point with a smaller audience because we're not discoverable on other platforms. I think the challenge with Facebook and Google from a content publisher's perspective is that they control discovery, they control monetization, they control promotion. They can take all of those things away or they can amplify them completely on their whim. And so as a result, as an independent publisher, when you play on Facebook, Instagram, Google, Twitter, TikTok, you name it, there's a risk because that company, the platform, can always take away the eyeballs that they gave you. And by virtue of having your content on those platforms, they play a role and take a cut of monetization. I think the same thing is happening in the restaurant business. You look at Grubhub, you look at Uber Eats, you look at Postmates or Seamless. And on one hand, you can argue that those companies have made it possible for restaurants to stay in business during a pandemic or to find new customers by virtue of being part of a bigger menu on somebody else's platform. That's one argument. I think the second argument is that these companies aren't in fact that great for restaurants by virtue of how much of a cut they take of their business. So if you look at Postmates, it's taking a 30% cut of restaurants, of the order from a restaurant. You look at Grubhub, they're taking somewhere between 20 and 30%. There's all sorts of marketing fees. You look at Postmates, maybe they're taking as high, I think Uber Eats takes as high as like 40%. So like, that's a pretty fucking big percentage just for the delivery company. And so what's interesting, Grubhub launched a commercial, I think, last week where they're thanking restaurants. And I was watching it and thinking to myself, like, yeah, absolutely. Like, Grubhub is like, oh, shit, now everybody's going out to restaurants. We need to make sure people don't forget to order at home. But I also think there's something slightly hypocritical or ironic in a platform which is taking such a cut of that company's business to be thanking them for what actually makes their business different and special. So we'll hit up a clip from the Grubhub commercial. But I think this is interesting. And it's also, you know, it's one of the things that's very interesting for businesses, whether you have a physical business like a restaurant or you have a digital business like ours, is how much do you want to grow and at what price? And at what point does being discoverable somewhere else or being available someone else actually hurt your core business? All right, so let's roll the clip.
Here's to you, restaurants. Thank you from the bottom of our stomachs for making life more delicious. Thanks for handling the heat and the dishes. For the rogue onion ring that ends up in our fries. And for discovering the miracle of bacon stuffed lobster.
Okay, so we can't use the whole commercial, but you guys generally get the gist. Thank you, restaurants. All right, so let's do a quick segue to the digital ad business. So the advertising revenue in the U.S. Is expected to increase 22% in 2021 to around $280 billion. This is well above a forecast done last December. Now, as you guys remember, by virtue of the pandemic, there's been a huge amount of uncertainty about the ad business. Will consumer spending go down? Are advertisers going to come back? Will they be marketing their wares? Think about the categories that were affected by the pandemic where you couldn't get supply or you weren't using their services or you couldn't outright go to those places by virtue of being shut down. What's interesting to see is that the ad business has rebounded in a way that's been even more dramatic than people expected by a factor of two. What's also interesting to our earlier conversation is that most of the growth in the ad business was attributed to three companies: Facebook, Amazon, and Google. And their first quarter 2021 results is what is driving the forecast. What's also very interesting, also by virtue of these companies, is that digital advertising is going to account for 57% of all advertising in the U.S. I can remember starting my career in advertising, working in digital. Digital like got shit on all the time. Like, nobody cared about the internet people. Everyone was about print or about television. And I think digital spending back then was like 5%, 10%, 12%. We were like, will it ever get to 25%? awesome to see in 2021 that 57% of all advertising will go to digital platforms. I think you could argue whether it's a good thing or a bad thing that it's so concentrated with Amazon, Facebook, and Google, but that is what it is. And obviously the government is going to have quite a say in that. But it's also a great thing to see the economy rebounding in a way that I think most people didn't expect that it would. So speaking of advertising, we have a great partnership with Ad Results Media. What I love about Ad Results Media is that I believe that buying advertising isn't a science and it isn't an art. It's really the combination of those two things. You have to understand where you're advertising. You have to understand how your advertising is going to work. You have to understand the environments that you're advertising in. And when you think about podcasting, that is one of the most nuanced, volatile, creator-driven spaces out there. And what Ad Results Media does so well is that they understand which platforms will work, they understand which shows perform, but they also understand how to make a brand come to life in the midst of a very creative environment. If you want to learn more about what Ad Results has done, you can go to adresultsmedia.com/token. That's adresultsmedia.com/token, and you can see what they've done for brands like ButcherBox, MeUndies, ZipRecruiter, and more. So while we're talking about advertising, let's talk about Call Her Daddy. So congratulations to Alex Cooper. Alex Cooper and Call Her Daddy, which is her juggernaut podcast. I read someone leaked the Spotify internal memo announcing Alex's joining Spotify, that this is the fifth biggest podcast on Spotify. So that says two things to me, which is one, I thought that the Spotify podcasting business was perhaps way bigger than it is. I mean, if she's top five, think about the money they've paid for Rogan, The Ringer, Rosillo, etc. Like that's interesting, Joe Budden. So congratulations to Alex. She was a top podcast here. Alex and her podcast are going to move exclusively to Spotify. So what that means is that Call Her Daddy will only be available to be downloaded on Spotify. You can't find it on Apple. You won't be able to find it on other platforms. She'll still have video on YouTube. And the best part of it, from my vantage point, is she'll still be partnering with Barstool Sports. So I love Alex Cooper. I've had an incredible relationship working with her. I think she is first rate. I love what she is about. I think she is truly a rare creator, and I'm so excited about her vision for Call Her Daddy and where it goes. And I'm excited that we'll play a role in that. Dave and I have been talking to Alex about what she does next for probably close to 6 months now. She's got an awesome team around her. I'm excited, and I believe that her brand will grow on Spotify. But I'm also excited for us to play a very big role as her partner in creating a newsletter and her platform for her merchandise, which, to be honest, is, I think, one of the best things that we brought to the table for Alex, in addition to obviously igniting the fire around Call Her Daddy in the first place and really pouring gasoline on what is a very creative, very funny, very entertaining podcast. So you'll still be able to find anything and everything Call Her Daddy on Barstool Sports. We are still going to have a great relationship with Alex, and we wish her and the Spotify team all the best in moving the pod exclusively to Spotify. You know, Dave talked about this on his show, which is, you know, we've been in a discussion with Alex for months now. She's got a great team around her. I actually really enjoyed working with them. And the reality is that the premium for creators right now is extremely high. Spotify wants audience. I read the internal memo at Spotify leaked, and they called Alex and Call Her Daddy a top five show there, which is pretty interesting. I have no doubt, I see the numbers every day, that Alex is a top five show. But also, when you look at how much Spotify has invested in podcasting, The Ringer, Gimlet, Joe Budden, Joe Rogan, I would have thought that their podcast network might have been bigger. And so it's very obvious that they're hell-bent on growing their podcast platform. She's going to be a big juggernaut for them in being able to do that. I also think having a very fresh female voice is always a good thing. You know, you don't see a whole lot of that in the podcast space in general. You don't see it at Spotify. So I think this is a great win for them. And we're excited to continue our relationship with her. So while we're talking about commerce, Netflix also has announced that they are getting into the D2C business. So Netflix has created a store. You don't have to have Netflix to be able to shop in their store. Although, who doesn't have Netflix at this point? I mean, really? You don't have Netflix, Frankie? Why? Do you watch television?
No, I don't even have TV.
But do you watch, like, on your computer?
Sports only.
Well, all right. Everyone except Frankie has a Netflix account. Everyone besides Frankie might be buying T-shirts. They've mentioned that they're going to be getting into action figurines. I think this is interesting because it says a couple things. Is one, Reed Hastings is a genius in my opinion, like one of the most disciplined visionary CEOs out there. But it's also very obvious that he's trying to supplement his subscription revenue, and that even Netflix is finding new ways to monetize its audience. If you think about it, this is also their first big step in competing with Disney in being a lifestyle brand. I think once you get into the T-shirts and the hats and the action figures and the toothbrushes and all that stuff, you start to look like a lifestyle company and an IP company. And so I think that that's the move that Netflix is making. It'll be interesting to see how the store performs. It will also be interesting to see where else they put that store. So it's like, when's the Netflix theme park coming to life? Also interesting, just going to the numbers really quickly. In Q1 2020, Netflix added 16 million subs. And in Q1 2021, Netflix added 4 million subs. Now, obviously, last January, you had nothing to do but watch Netflix and stay home and be depressed about the pandemic. This year, people have stuff to do. But it's interesting to see how Netflix is going to look more like Disney. I think Disney Plus just crossed 100 million subs, which is about half of Netflix's numbers. So the arms race around the premium video platforms is expanding. And then they're also starting to look more and more like one another in the creation of IP and the lifestyling of those IP businesses. Instagram is also working to be a better D2C platform for influencers. So I don't know if anyone is following this, but influencers are all pissed off at Instagram for all the reasons that I mentioned around antitrust and around why it's hard for publishers and creators to work with those platforms. What influencers are complaining about is that they don't control discovery, they don't understand the algorithm, and that things change all the time and they have no ability to understand. There's no transparency around that change. So the influencers on Instagram who are trying to build their businesses on Instagram are upset about policy changes. They're upset about having no visibility into promotion or how to make the algorithm work. And then I think I would say that they seem resentful about the shit they have to do to trick the algorithm. And we see this all the time. We play these games all the time. But essentially, if you have a business that's built on distribution and social media, you wake up, you open the app, and you're trying to understand what gimmick you can try to find more eyeballs. The only thing Instagram is really doing, I think there's probably a lot of fanfare about making this seem bigger, but they're essentially allowing influencers to be affiliates. So if you're on Instagram, you're making a Reels, you're doing something, and you're wearing a T-shirt, you're wearing a Made Worn T-shirt, if you promote the link to Made Worn, you can get a cut of that sale. So I don't know how radical the changes are. It'll be interesting to see if this actually makes the influencers happy. So speaking of making things work and waking up and opening your app and figuring out how you're going to game the system today, it's better to do that while caffeinated. Black Rifle Coffee is a veteran-owned, American-owned coffee company. They make extremely premium coffee. They make it, I want to say, in Manchester, Tennessee, and Salt Lake City, Utah. Both seem like very clean, great places to make coffee. Like, I would trust coffee from those places. They have a great coffee club. They've got a ton of choices to choose from. And if you go to blackriflecoffee.com/token, you can get the best coffee in America shipped to you. just in case you want to become an influencer and promote your affiliate links on Instagram. So go to blackrifle.com/token, use code token, get yourself some great coffee, and then you can go be an influencer on Instagram. Other big announcement today is we've got socks coming for the Run Club. So they're awesome. They're like the 70s socks with the stripes around the top. I think they're great. I have two pairs of them. They say embrace the suck. The other thing we are launching is black shorts. So we have my dog shorts. I love these shorts. I actually played tennis in these shorts this weekend, and you can like shove the balls into the little pockets on the back. It's awesome. So if you want new shorts or socks for runners, if you are M. Najeki and you are just rocking our stuff, we've mentioned this episode is dedicated to her, she can get a pair of these. Maybe we'll even send her a pair, but you can get them at the Barstool Sports store. All right, so we're adding a new part of the show. It's our voicemail segment. We're taking a page out of KFC Radio and many other podcasts here, but one of the things we want to do is to connect with people around what their questions are, things they want to talk about. We want to meet all the personalities around this show. If you feel like leaving us a voicemail, you can call us at 440-462-1729. And then we'll incorporate these into the pod and we'll answer as many as we can. It was actually funny. My mom this weekend was like up my ass. My mom, very tragically, my mom's dachshund got run over, got run over by like a guy who drove into her driveway and ran over the dog. So my mom loves this dog, Mo. And so my mom was like, oh, can you tweet out where I can get a new dachshund? Is that what they're calling? It's a terrible dog. But she's like, can you tweet it out? And I was like, yeah. And then I finally like tweeted out, you know, hey, my mom's looking for a dachshund. Which people were so great about responding, so many dachshund pictures. And then my DMs were flooded with like, hey, I don't know anything about dachshunds, but I'd really like a job at Barstool Sports. And I was like, oh, I'm going to kill my mother. But anyways, it's my own fault. And she did find there was a couple people who gave a bunch of, there's a rescue league on Craigslist. There's another group on Facebook. So hopefully my mother will get a new dog. If you're listening to this and you have a lead on a 3 to 5 year old dachshund, let us know. Otherwise, you can continue to DM me for job opportunities. So the line is 440-462-1729, and we'll play our first one.
Just a question regarding mentorship. So I've had a lot of great mentors in my life. I guess what are some of your strategies on finding the best mentor for you and to help you succeed within your career? Thanks again. Love the show. Take care. See you. Bye.
Question on how do you find the right mentor? So what I would say is I don't really believe in like check the box mentorship. Like I think you can have all different types of mentors that show themselves in all different types of ways. Like I would consider Vince McMahon a mentor of mine. Vince McMahon does not give me the time of day on a phone call to talk about a set agenda, but watching him work is inspiring to me and I learn from it. So in my mind, mentorship is really being connected to people who can teach you things, people who can be a soundboard for you, people who have an outside or different or more seasoned perspective who can give you the insights you need to be successful. So the first thing I would do is think about all the people in your network. You may work with them on a day-to-day basis. You may have met them in college. You had a professor. Maybe it's people you admire at other companies. And I think what's most important is really take the time to study that person and to see what you can learn from them and to apply it to yourself. Like, I'll give you an example. Like, I would also list Dion as a mentor. Like, I wake up every morning and get a text from Deion Sanders with probably hundreds of other people about what Deion's thinking about today. And it's really inspiring to me. Like it might sound cheesy, like half of it doesn't apply to me. Today was about whether you're a dad or a son. But I like the idea that Deion has this like joy for life and he has this zest and he has this journey that he's on. And I think being a mentor means taking things from what he has to say and applying them to my own life. So I think everyone can do that all the time. And someone doesn't even need to know that they're your mentor, that you think about them that way. I think you can also have really practical mentors where people actively help you solve problems. And in that regard, I would find someone who you feel is successful and in a place where you want to go. So it doesn't have to be way more senior than you. It doesn't have to be a lot of time with this person. But I think finding someone you admire, approaching them in a way that says, hey, I'd love to learn from you. Can you spare 30 minutes from me? Take notes at that meeting and then think about how you can internalize that, which pieces speak most to you and which you can apply to your job to make you better at it. So that's how I would think about mentorship.
Hi, I love the podcast. I'm a college student trying to break into the television production industry or just digital media production, anything like that. And my question is in regards to a post that you just made about with every job application, you should do at least one of the following, and it has all these things about reaching out to people within the company. But how do you do this without sounding like needy or like you want something? Like obviously you want something, but how do you make it sound organic?
I'd summarize this question as like how to make a connection without feeling like you're mooching from someone or you're too needy or you're asking too much. So thanks for calling in. I would strongly advise you to go into digital production versus television production. First of all, that's just my biased 2 cents. But if you look at the TV industry, to our last point about digital advertising growing, advertising makes the content business go round. Digital advertising is growing double digit. TV advertising is growing like 8%. So when you think about what the world is going to look like, there's going to be way more digital production than TV production. Now, that said, when I was in college, I just wanted to get a job anywhere. So power to you if you can get a job in production, period, and you can always parlay that to something new. I don't think it seems needy to show interest in something. I do think it seems needy when you come across as self-serving. So like back to all the people DMing me for jobs because I tweeted about my mother's desire for a new dachshund. Like the ones that I actually read and was interested in always said something about the person, always said something about why they were interested in learning from me in particular or wanting something from me in particular, and always said something about where this person wants to go. I think the people who come across as like, me, 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 hey, help me, like, I need, I want, that's not compelling. I think if you can make someone feel like you're interested in them, that you want to learn from them specifically, and that you're going to take whatever kernel you get from them and put it to something greater, I think those are the people that other people want to help. And so I think there's a ton of ways where you can say, hey, I'm a college kid. I'm reaching out. I'm trying to get involved in the production space. I'm really interested in your show, your company, your career. Say something specific. And then say, I'd love to learn something because, and say how you're going to use it. My hope is to have as great a career in TV production, digital production, set design, blah, 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 you name it. So I would frame things that way, and I think you'll have the best chance of getting a response. Also, don't feel bad if you don't get a response. I think people are inundated with requests every day. So just because someone doesn't respond to you doesn't mean you're not doing a good job asking, and it doesn't mean you're coming across needy or mooching.
Hi, Erica. My question for you is, I've worked in customer service roles at a big company for, like, on the phone, maybe for about 5 or so years now, and I'm looking to move up. Unfortunately, my field that I work in now, travel, isn't really hiring due to COVID and the pandemic. So when applying for new jobs, how do I leverage that to move up? I want a little bit more in my role. I want some more responsibility. Basically, I'm tired of doing customer service, working on the phone, would love a different position in a different industry or in a different department. But how do I leverage moving out of basically that entry-level customer service role?
Okay, great question. How do you move into a new role? The first thing I would say is 5 years doing anything, especially an entry-level job, is a really long time. So you should get going. Like, you should be moving into a new role. I've been at Barstool Sports now 5.5 years, and I'm like, Jesus, I've been here a long time. Like, think it's the longest job I've ever had. So 5 years at a job is a long time. Good for you in wanting to move up and on, and you should get after it. I think the first thing is customer service is one of the hardest jobs out there, and you need to articulate why customer service, what you've learned from customer service, and why the skills that you've learned are transferable or applicable. So I think it's very easy for you to move into a customer service role in another sector. That's a no-brainer. I think if you want to move into a different type of role overall, you need to identify what those roles are. What are roles that are adjacent to customer service? And why does understanding how to work with customers, resolve claims, be very organized, have good people skills and good interpersonal skills, why does this set you up for being a good candidate for an adjacent type job? And I think if you can outline those two things, articulate it in a cover letter or in a resume, more importantly, and go out and proactively outreach to people. I think customer service jobs are hard to fill. I think there's probably a very high degree of burnout. I mean, that's a shitty job. So find a way to take what you're doing, articulate it in a way that makes someone want to hire you, and use that, and then be very aggressive about outreach. Customer service, as I understand it, is very quota driven. Give yourself a quota about reaching out to people to get a new job, and then go see what it yields. So this is a long episode. As with most long episodes, it leaves you wanting a drink. I love Owen's Craft Mixers. So if you feel like having a delicious, refreshing mixer, you don't even actually have to have alcohol. You could just drink it. I think the transfusion is amazing. It's basically like grape juice and ginger ale. If you want to add a little vodka, that's great. If you don't, you just put it over ice. It tastes amazing. What's incredible about Owen's Craft Mixers is they take all the guesswork out of making a great cocktail. Like, I was trying to make margaritas the other night, and I realized that I only really know how to squeeze limes and put tequila in and then rim the glass with salt. I was like, there's probably way more to this. I think triple sec plays a role. There's all these other liqueurs that go into it. I know nothing about that. What's great about Owen's is Owen's makes it so I don't even have to care. You can get a six pack, you can bring it home, you put it in your fridge, and when you feel like making a cocktail, you literally crack open the can, you add the alcohol, and you're done. The great thing about Owen's is it's available on Amazon. I buy everything on Amazon. Obviously, everyone buys everything on Amazon. Probably not Frankie. Do you buy anything on Amazon? Nope. Frankie doesn't use Amazon. So back to the rock. So anyways, if you want to get yourself some Owen's Craft Mixers, you can get them on Amazon. It's one day shipping. So if you're thinking about what to do this weekend, you can be like, all right, I'm going to place my order on Tuesday. You'll have it by Wednesday, maybe Thursday, worst case scenario. So you're all ready for the weekend. The other place you can get it is at CVS stores nationwide. So have yourself a great mixer. Finally, we have Rebecca Minkoff joining us. For anybody who doesn't know, Rebecca Minkoff is a self-made fashion designer. She's had incredible success in the handbag category, in the apparel category. She's just written a book called Fearless. I loved it. I'll give you a quick rundown on her rules to being fearless, which is how she's organized this book. If you want to go, go. Go for purpose over payout. Don't ask for help. Ask for what you need. Give your all. All that matters is your point of view. Love it and leave it. Be okay with walking away. Be better together. Practice with partnerships. Communicate your heart out. Change things up. Skip the shortcuts. Play the wild card. She's got all these chapters, 21 chapters of this book, so it's a great investment. And she joins us to talk about what it was like to break into fashion, the lessons that she learned along the way, and the advice that she has for people, not only in the fashion industry, but in any industry, for living their best life and being the best that they can be at work. Okay, so Rebecca, welcome to the Token CEO podcast. We are excited to have you. I have a bunch of your handbags, and actually, I'm annoyed that I didn't wear it today, but the striped princess sleeve, like, it's my dream. Like, princess sleeves and stripes, you know, the ones that are out right now? I mean, I love it.
Oh, I know. I have them in every color times two. Yes.
I love that. I have the royal blue and white one, and then I have the yellow and white one, which I highly recommend. You can get them at Nordstrom. That's where I got mine. Or you can get them on your website. But tell us a little bit about you. Like, what makes you tick? How did you make it to the top of the fashion heap? And then what made you decide to write about it all?
I made it to the top of the fashion heap. I love the way you put that. really by breaking a lot of rules. Some of the things I'll say right now are like, maybe people can't even remember there was a time before social media or a time when people didn't look at bloggers. But when we launched, we didn't have the right connections and came from the right family or the money to get where we wanted. We were truly brought our success by the consumer who found us. She found us on these early web blogs, these forums where girls were in rooms talking about us. We had some great celebrities wearing the bags. And then we needed to innovate. And so we began to talk to our customer, which was considered shocking and terrible. And we began to hire and use influencers and, you know, be in touch. And again, we were talked off ledges. We were told we shouldn't do that. Stores wouldn't buy us. But we felt that that was the future. So I think with the clever use of technology and good design, we were able to break through and have a lane that we get to play in today.
So what made you decide, like, we're going for this, like, we're going to do it?
I think that we saw this surge of demand for this one bag. It really resonated and hit a zeitgeist. You know, women have these milestone moments that they hit, and their bag is usually the prize, right? When they get their first job, their first raise, yep, a divorce, a date, right? And so we just hit this moment and we said, we got to pour everything into this. Let's see if we can hitch our wagon to the star. So that was the morning after bag. And that ride lasted a really long time. And then by then we had more bags and, you know, more hits and, you know,
yep,
we're always trying to find the next bag.
You're exactly right on that. I remember graduating from college and my roommate, the Kate Spade bag was so big back then. Remember the black square? It was before Kate Spade kind of became basic and sold out, which all due respect, but Kate Spade was so culty and it was like maybe a $350 bag or something, which was like exorbitantly expensive. But you're exactly right. My roommate Alyssa got the Kate Spade bag. I got like a suede Coach bag. But you're right that it commemorates an accomplishment or a moment. Do you still think it's like that for women with fashion? Because there is something lasting about a bag. It's like a bag or a watch. I think shoes are kind of a foolish purchase because they get destroyed, but that's just me.
Yeah, I definitely think and see that our customer is buying a bag 1 to 2 times a year. She's buying clothing all the time. She could, you know, you don't really hold on to a ton of clothing as like the classic item, maybe a few things. But I think bags are investment pieces. And so I think when you get a good brand that's affordable and luxury, I think that she definitely holds on to it.
And do you study your consumer all the time? Like, do you walk down the street and you're like, is that my girl? Is that my girl? Like, how, like, what's the secret to you knowing what the right look, the right product, the right attitude is? Because I think that there is something timeless about your brand in that it's classic, but not, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always looking, whether it's less so on the street these days than I'd like to be. But, you know, in airports, at events, you know, I'm always spotting. And I think what sets our bags apart is the idea that we're not shouting out loud, this is the big plaque that you spent a couple $1,000s on. We're really about the woman, the whole woman being noticed for her style. And so my logo is always discreet. It's always on the bottom, yep, the back, or if it is in the front, it's like you can barely see it. Because I really want the woman, the whole woman, to shine, not like, here's my expensive bag. Everybody know that I have money.
Totally. I hate that. I went to a lacrosse game yesterday, literally standing on asphalt, and there was a woman there with a Chanel bag that was like screaming Chanel. It literally was screaming at me. This bag was screaming at me. And I'm like, who the hell shows up at a lacrosse game with a Chanel bag? But I think people do that, but it's more, I think it's tacky because it's more about, oh, I have a lot of money and I've got like a bag, versus when I wear your clothes or when I think people think about Rebecca Minkoff, it's like, it's a beautiful straw bag that makes my outfit really come together, or is practical. It holds my lip gloss and my phone and whatever. And it's not screaming. It's not competing with me for attention when I'm out in public.
Totally. And even when we developed perfume, I was like, I hate it when the smell walks into a room before the woman does. You should want to smell this woman once you've embraced her. You know,
totally.
There's something to be said about the woman is the hero. And then all these things are there to amplify her.
So because you are so disruptive and, you know, kind of broke into fashion without the permission or the pedigree, the way you put it, are you a control freak? Like, how maniacal are you? Like, you like you've written this book Fearless, and I think that that's clearly very much a part of your DNA. Like the thing I like about your book is that you make being fearless seem very normal. Like there's very practical things you can do to be fearless. So was that a necessity for you, or did you just have that coming in?
I think part of it is developed over the last 20 years. I think, you know, my mom raised me to be a fighter, and she, you know, I was born into two older brothers, and she said, oh, I got to make this girl tough. And she raised our whole family. Like if we ever wanted anything, we had to work for it. So I think some people's fear of, I don't know how to do that, didn't happen to me, because I was like, I've had to figure stuff out my whole life. Nothing was ever handed to me. So I know how to figure stuff out. But then it comes the time when you are scared, right? Like we're scared. The goal of my book isn't that you read it and you're like, I'm no longer scared of anything. It's more like you just don't let it stop you. And I think that had to get learned through doing something that scared me, coming out. I'm still alive. I'm here. What? Okay, let's do it again. And now the things that thrill me are the things that used to scare me. So I think
yep.
I liken it to, you know, someone that's addicted to adrenaline and wants to go skydiving. You know, I think you get better at it.
And how do you feel like, what I really liked about the book is, you know, you're just very, I like people that speak in English, which I think is rare. That sounds strange, but it's like, you know when to walk away, like learn how to communicate, just say no. Like how much failure did you have to go through to learn all these lessons? Like how do you look back, you know, how do you look back on the last 20 years and how did you, you know, how did you apply your own lessons when you failed?
I think that if I were to share all of the failure, then no one would ever want to be in business. Everyone would run. Yeah. So my goal was to write a book that was light enough that you could be like, okay, you know, because there's some dark moments as an entrepreneur when you risk losing your business. You know, you have employees betray you, stores close and owe you money. And, you know, like we've had anything bad that you could think of has happened. And I think the signal difference, and it's in one of my chapters, is success is being able to keep going. It's just getting back up and putting one foot in front of the other. That alone will keep you, you know, when most people are like, you know what, I'm tapping out. This is not worth it. And you're like, oh, I'm going to get back up again. Don't know why, but I'm going to do it.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's right. When we talk about building Barstool Sports, I'm like, we have failed our way to success. Like, truly, we have failed every single step of the way. And I think you're right. At some point in time, people stop getting back up again. I think the other thing is that there's so many people who just want status quo, which is really sad. Like, I find that, like, I think the fastest way to age right now is to just want the status quo and to not keep getting up and keep learning things and keep messing up. And what I love about what you're doing is giving people, not just women, but giving them the benefit of your experience of getting back up every day. And I think that that's really something that people can take with them. Were there people who did this for you during your career?
I think what I had was a series of women that were, again, more tough love. You know, when I was first fired from the company I worked at, she's like, I need all of you or none of you. You're fired. Go do it. I know where your heart is. You know, the next woman was the woman who actually was responsible for Kate Spade's, you know, rise. She was like the place to be, the showroom to be in for bags. And she was tough. You didn't get the warm cozies from her, you know.
Yep.
She would very openly declare when you failed, how you failed, and get your shit together. And so that can be hard for people to stomach, but I just took it as, you know what, she's here, she's giving me feedback, she wants to see this grow, and she's got a proven track record, so I better listen to her.
And did you like go have a cry and then get your shit together? Or are you like, did your mom make you like, I'm rough and tumble and I'm just taking it and moving on?
No, I think my worst moment with her was we had decided to take our apparel business in-house and she wanted the sales from it. She was doing the bag sales, but she wasn't known as a destination for apparel. And so we took it in-house and the news reached her before I did.
Okay.
And she said, come pick up your shit. We're done. Your stuff is in garbage bags waiting for you. And I was like shaking. I didn't cry. I was in this little alleyway corner of our office. It's like where the fire escape was, on the floor, like going like this.
Rocking in the fetal position.
Yeah. Yes. And I was like, we're going to find a way through. We have to. And I called her back. I was like, you can't do this. You know what? We're going to work this out, and I'll come up there and talk to you, but I'm not coming to pick up my stuff. So we worked it out for a little bit longer, and we ended amicably several years later, but it was a tough moment because at that time, direct to consumer wasn't a thing. So to have somebody tell you, we're done, get out of here, you don't have a way.
You
to
lost your distribution.
Yeah, exactly.
And how do you think that, do you think that fashion brands resent going direct to consumer? Like, that's clearly always been something that's part of your brand's DNA. How do you think that that is, like, I'll give you an example. Sorry, this is long-winded, but I remember I was at a startup, a fashion media company startup, and I had got this interview with these two designers, like two well-known designers, two men. And they were looking for someone who understood digital, and they were looking for someone who understood the internet and was would build the marketing and digital around their business. And I had a lunch with them in the West Village, and I remember just hammering them, asking like, "Who does your social media? Who does your social media? Who does your social media?" And they were like, looked at each other, and they're like, "We don't, like, we're too big for this. Like, we don't really know. I think it's somebody's assistant or, you know, part time that's that." And I was like, "Well, you're never going to be successful if you're looking at the internet as the assistant of the assistant's job." And needless to say, I didn't get a job working for them. But do you think that, you were obviously early on it, but do you think you have a different point of view around going direct to consumer? Like, how do you think that works in the world you live in now?
I mean, I think for us, it's a no-brainer. I think there are probably designers who have luxury goods who would prefer that, you know, when you're selling something that's $5,000-$10,000, it can kind of feel, if it's too accessible and it's direct to consumer, that it's not worth it. You know, I think that's why Chanel doesn't have a direct to consumer business, right? And why they're very protective of who sells them online. I don't even think you can get Chanel bags online. So I think that they want to, the only value, you know, because I know how much those bags cost to make, right, is by making it scarce. But we're accessible luxury. You know, our bags top out at $400. So we want to be everywhere. We want to be the bag at the lacrosse game or the football game or soccer game, whatever it is. And so for us, we have to be where that woman is, and she's online and she's shopping. And then when she wants to go have her Chanel experience with the champagne and the thing, she goes to have that experience in store.
And is that a better business? Like, I think about it like there, you have one, I don't have a Chanel bag, obviously, but like you have one Chanel bag, or you're going to have like five Rebecca Minkoff bags. Like, is your bet the right bet for a business? Like, talk a little bit about how you think about that.
I mean, I could only talk about my experience in launching this. You know, to become a luxury brand usually means you have to have heritage, a lot of money, or the right editors or the right people sort of backing you. There's very few luxury brands that have emerged that haven't been around for a long time. So I think that what I set out to do when I started was, you know, I was 25. I could not pay my rent. I could barely eat in New York City. I set out to make a bag that someone like me could buy or aspire to buy once they got their first job. So it was never a question. We've pushed our prices up. Many years ago, we decided to launch bags for $1,000, $2,000. And, you know, at the end of the day, it was like, well, Chanel's only another $1,000. Why not? Why wouldn't she, you know, at that price, why wouldn't she?
Yep.
But I think for us, we really found like our niche is this accessible luxury price point.
I love that. I think that that's smart. I mean, we have an accessible brand. I argue that we're like sneaky premium, but it's like, I want to be for everybody. I want to find as many people as possible. Like, I think one of the things about luxury is how it, like, fuck you exclusionary it is. And yeah. I don't say it in a bad way. Like, it's cool to have something no one else has. Like, people since the beginning of time have wanted that. But yeah. I also think there's something, what I love about your brand is that you get who she is, and you want to embrace her in her journey in a way that like is supportive to her. And I think there's a difference in that. I love that.
There seems to be sometimes a snobbery that wasn't me organically. And like, you know, I think that my goal is to make a woman feel good, not make her feel less.
And how do you think about, as you've grown up, has your customer changed? Like, has she grown with you, or are you still finding the 25-year-old version of yourself?
So we did two things. One was a mistake. She was with me. She was growing with me. And then I hit 31. And all of a sudden, some people within the company felt like we should peg our customer at 27 and just talk to her. And I kept going with my life. I had kids, I had family. And my customer that had grown up with me was like, what happened to Rebecca?
She's Where'd you go?
Talking to 27-year-olds who are still out partying every night. And for a couple of years, I was like, this is not right. It does not make sense. And finally, my vindication was that, no, we can talk to both, you know, but let's be real and authentic about who I am if people like and care. And so since we did that, we've gotten our old customer back, but then we see a new one coming as well.
Yep. And how much do you, like, how public is your life? Like, how much do you make yourself part of your story?
So I would say we've tested a lot of things. When I was doing the, like, reality show, yes, we got tons and tons of engagement and likes. But it is also, like, do you really want to see my son's dirty diaper? Does that make you want to buy a bag for me? Probably not. And so I think recently we've taken steps to sort of not cut me back, but just show the things that matter. Mm-hmm. And you don't need to see like what I look like in the morning. Mm-hmm. You don't need to see my desk. What you want to see is things that still excite you and keep you excited about the brand and the bag. So I think, you know, that's the kind of view we've honed in.
Yeah, I like that. So talk about wanting to write a book. Like, what was the process like? Did you, you know, are you happy with it? Is it something like you're like, oh, I hate page 47? Like, talk about that process.
So the writing of the book itself was less hard than the actual, okay, now it's done and now you got to sell it.
Yep.
And all the work that comes with that. I think what was interesting about writing the book is as I was writing about what I did to build the brand, we were in the pandemic almost losing our company. And so how do I revisit what we did to ensure that we stayed alive mm-hmm. through the pandemic. Not that I would ever say that was good timing, but it was fortuitous in a way. There's definitely pages I hate, but I think that any writer is so close to it, their nose is smashed up against it. I've read that book 100 times.
Yeah.
I read the audio book. So I have no perspective on it whatsoever anymore, but I'm really proud of it. And when I hear again, people like it, they feel like it's helpful, they've read it. Then I'm like, okay, it's good. I can do that.
And do you have a favorite chapter?
I think the last chapter where I talk about the pandemic and what we went through and how we had to rebuild and why these rules were so helpful during that time.
I think, you know what I like about what you're saying is that I agree with you that if it's not authentic, it just won't work. Like, you pretending you're still talking to a 25-year-old when you're 35 is like bullshit. Like, everybody sees through that. You see through it. You don't feel good doing it. And what I like about the book is almost the arc and your discovery. It seems like your discovery of like, ooh, the things that worked for me when I was 25 are the things working for you now with a different set of challenges in a different era with a different size business. And I think that's something, you know, it's kind of like when you think about your life, you always go back to a couple core pieces of advice that serve you well. It's just in different circumstances.
Totally. And I think that we're always evolving. So we're always going to have a different perspective on things and an ability to be like, you know, it's not like I knew what the rules were when I was doing it. I was just doing it, you know,
yeah.
And it took 20 years to reflect back and go, oh, that's what I was doing. Okay. That's, I can pull this nugget out to help someone else.
And were you able to see those learnings? Like, I always feel like I've had so many learnings and so many mess ups and there've been some successes and highs in there. And then I'm like, oh shit, I forgot about that. Like, did you keep a journal along the way? Like, how did you have someone help you pull this out of you? Like, how'd you manifest all this wisdom?
So the woman that was responsible, or I feel responsible for my success, she wrote the Daily Candy article about me that kind of launched the excitement around the bag. And I flew out to LA back at the beginning of 2020 in January before the world ended.
Yeah.
And we sat there for 3 days and she just interviewed me and she just asked and pulled out questions. She recorded it all. And so her jogging my memory and sort of pulling out the story. And then we did those calls every week from March until August. So she would just pull it out of me and then we would write it down and then we'd be like, all right, how does this look work here? Let's do it in order. So her interviewing me and triggering those memories was the most helpful way to get it out of me.
That's awesome. I love that. I think that's great. That's like a great way to do things. Remember Daily Candy? I loved Daily Candy.
Yeah, right?
Wasn't it the best?
It was the best.
Do you guys even know what Daily Candy is? You guys have no idea what Daily Candy is. Oh, it was this fashion newsletter. It was so delightful. It was city-based, right?
It was city-based, and it was one perfect thing you needed to have every day. This was back before people got emails, so it was still special.
It was so special. It had this like whimsical little illustration. And then it was like, where are all the sample sales? I lived in Boston and it had all the New York sample sales. All I ever wanted in life was to go to a sample sale. Like truly that I was like, I will make it if I can go to a sample sale. Okay, Rebecca, since you are a fashion goddess, talk to us about what we should be wearing this summer.
Well, I think we've all spent a long time inside. So you definitely want to hold on to your matching jumpsuit that you have, your matching sweatsuit that you have. I think you talked about the Talia with the little puff sleeve, the striped
sweater.
It's called a sweatshirt, but it's really not. It's just a little bit of a thicker cotton shirt. And dresses. We have some extraordinary dresses and jumpsuits. I think, you know, it's time people are getting out there and barbecues and beach and fun. And just, yeah, it's time to put on that dress.
All right. I love it. Time to put on that dress. That's what we should call this episode. Rebecca, thank you so much. This was so helpful. Again, you can get your book wherever books are sold. I really loved it. I liked the script in it. I liked the chapters. I think the lessons are very helpful. Like, know when it's time to go. Sorry, one last non sequitur is you seem to like get shoved out of the nest a lot. Like you get fired. You're on your way. Your mother's like, you want to go to New York City? See ya. Go to New York City. Like, what do you think that how important do you think that is in making you who you are?
I think it's the thing that made me who I am. And it sucks when it's happening.
Sucks
big time. But it forges you into, you know, someone who can swim on your own. You know, you don't like, I think when people go like, what does success mean to you now? And people probably assume it's a certain number in your bank account, which is a nice thing to have. To me, success is knowing that this could go away tomorrow and I would build something else.
Yeah.
You know, that I could figure it out. And so to me, that's success, is that internal, I'll figure it out, I'll rebuild, I'll do something else and I'll make it again.
Like 1 foot, you just got to keep moving. Like you're the Dory of fashion. Like just keep swimming. Like let's go, you know? All right. Thank you for doing this. We appreciate you. Congratulations.
Yeah. Bye.
We'll see you soon. Bye. Okay, so huge thanks to Rebecca for joining us. I think what I loved the most about her interview was the idea of things scaring you and that you learn how to be fearless by being scared. So the more you put yourself in positions where things are scary, and the more you put yourself into situations that are uncertain, the more you can learn, the more courage you develop, and the more fearless you can be. The second, which I completely empathize with, is you can fail your way to success. The third is that if it's not authentic, it's not going to work. It doesn't matter if you work in content, you work in customer service, you work in fashion, you work in sports, you name it. People can see through inauthenticity, and being authentic is the best thing you can do to be successful. And then I also love that what she talked about was how if her business vanished today, if everything walked away, that her greatest skill is that she would pick up and do something else. And I think that's a great lesson for anybody, whether it's just in business, it's in your personal life, it's in your friend group, it's where you live. The idea of being able to fail or have something happen, wake up and get back on the horse again, is a great lesson in life. So that's it for today's episode. Big thanks to everyone who left a voicemail and to Rebecca for joining us. If you haven't already subscribed to the podcast, leave us a rating or give us a review, or you can call our voicemail line at 440-462-1729. You can watch this episode along with all others on our YouTube channel. Just search for Token CEO. If you haven't already, join our Facebook group. We talk shop, whether it's jobs, internships, careers, college degrees, work situations, you name it. And then you can follow us at EKA Nardini or Token CEO on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, and YouTube. We'll see you back here Thursday.